Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of Sweet Potato Sauron to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. The logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the appeal to common folk.
So the appeal to common folk is basically pretending that you are like the people you're talking to, or assuming the people you're talking to are common folk, are just kind of regular people. So trying to get them on your side, really, in the absence of making an argument, by just saying, you're like, look, I'm like you, we're all the same,
I'm just like you
should,
yeah.
You should think the same way as I do, because I'm basically the same as you, and that would make sense.
And you should support me, and I will uphold your desires because I know what they are.
Yeah, because I am you. I'm the same as you. So,
yeah. I'll champion your cause because your cause is my cause.
Absolutely. Yeah, I literally just thought of another example we could have used in Fallacy in the Wild this week, but we haven't. But it's for a while at least, Oprah's theme tune was "I'm Every Woman," which
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely is.
And Hannah Montana. I think there was a Miley Cyrus as Hannah Montana had a song called "I'm Just an Ordinary Girl," and you go, "Well, plainly you're not, because your dad is Billy Ray Cyrus, and you're on the telly, you know, so, and you've got a song out."
Yeah, so it's that kind of thing. It's just people who are in some way not like us saying, oh, "I'm just like you." So Trump is a really good example of this, because despite being a billionaire who received over $400 million in loans from his father, or money from his father, inheritance, over the course of his life, still claims to be like everyone else, and like, you know, just a kind of self-made businessman. And in fact, at one point when he was talking to some blue-collar workers, he said this:
"I'm proud that I've always treated the blue-collar worker, and I consider myself in a certain way to be a blue-collar worker, that make this country run with tremendous respect."
So he considers himself
in certain ways.
Yeah. In some of his suits have blue collars, I expect.
Blue collars on them. Yeah. Some of the $900 Italian shirts that he wears have probably got blue collars. Yeah. In a certain way, and they don't, and nobody questions it. They all just go,
yeah, you're just like us,
you're one of us, in his gold hard hat,
And the thing is, I think partly for Trump, where this comes from is his hatred of the real elites, the people who are actually running stuff and in charge of stuff, because.
Does he only hate them because they are actually in charge of stuff and running stuff?
I think he hates them because he would love to be part of that society, and they won't let him in because they realise that he's this awful, awful person, this gauche, kind of nouveau riche, inherited money person who doesn't understand the value of anything. And so they, you know,
everything valuable.
So when he bought Mar-a-Lago, there was a kind of a group of local hoteliers there who were kind of, you know, important and rich, and they wouldn't let him join their group. And he was like, bastards, it's complete shit, I should be allowed to. And then years later, he was saying, you know, I don't even want to be part of their group. I've got my own hotel and it's brilliant. And the same in the New York real estate business. Basically, no one admires him at all in the industry. They all think he's a piece of shit. But he desperately wants to be kind of part of the gang, part of the, it's like the world leaders. You know, he wants to be like them. He wants to, especially the kind of strong men. But they're just kind of, oh, what a fucking idiot this guy is. And so because...
Well, it's that kind of desperate thing. Well, and it's kind of, you know, even under Eric is you know, the same way. It's probably because Trump was... He was desperate to be admired and respected by his dad, and who doesn't? Mm. And then consequently, he's trying to do that with everybody else, and he just comes across as too needy and too shortcutty. He's like buying his way into these elite clubs or into somebody's affection.
But he then kind of funnels that into this hatred of the upper echelons of society, then kind of gives him an in with the working class poor who feel hard done by and feel like they should. And I'm not saying all the working class poor feel like that. I'm saying the ones who do feel like that see an ally in him of, you know...
Despite the fact that he's one of the people that... Yeah.
It's his foot on their neck.
That hasn't exactly. It's utter disdain for them.
Yeah,
and you know, except in certain respects, when it comes to elections.
Yeah,
I'm a blue collar worker.
Yeah,
yeah.
Or rather than kind of bringing himself down to what he might see as their level, he tries to kind of raise his crowd up to what he would see as his level, which is what happened here.
I meet these people. They call them the elite. These people, I look at them, I say, that's elite. We got more money, we got more brains, we got better houses, apartments, we got nicer boats, we're smarter than they are. And they say, the elite, we're the elite, you're the elite. We're the elite. So I said the other day, let's keep calling these people. And look, let's face it, they've been stone cold losers, the elite, the elite. So let's let them keep calling themselves the elite. But we're going to call ourselves, and remember, you are indeed, you work harder, but you are indeed smarter than them. Let's call ourselves from now on the super elite. We're the super elite. We are the super elite.
So there's this weird kind of dichotomy of hating the people at the top and saying, but actually we're the ones at the top. We're more elite than they are, but elitism is bad.
And also, they've got, some people are more elite than others. They're elite bad, our elite good.
Yeah.
And the thing is that actually, in some respects, he is a blue-collar worker, like when he hosted that meal to the homecoming basketball team and then gave them all
cold McDonald's on a silver platter. Absolutely. His kind of
is that because he's trying to be the common man and giving them what they want, or he actually is just the common man?
I mean, I've seen it described
in a palace
as that he is the reason that some poor people kind of respond to him so well is because his kind of flaunting of wealth in such a kind of gauche way gives the impression that he is a person who has got rich unexpectedly and is still really excited about all the stuff you can do if you're rich. It's like he hasn't got the class or the culture or the upbringing or anything like that. He's just got the money.
And
in that way, so it's like that's what I would be like if I was rich. I'd buy McDonald's and stuff like that too.
Well, I went to I visited Hearst Castle on the west coast of California, and that's, you know, well, he's kind of Citizen Kane, you know, it's William Randolph Hearst, and he is like that. He got rich very quickly by being a media mogul, and it's, you can tell he's just bought stuff by the yard, you know. He's bought Italian tapestries. And if they're too long, he just chops them down a bit to fit in the room. Or there was one ceiling which he took from the inside of a monastery in Spain, and it's beautiful, but it's not long enough for the room. So he just made a fake bit to go in the end. And it's just that kind of, yeah. There was a moment I can recall when there was a documentary about Bruce Forsyth, British light entertainer, who, and you got to go around his house, and it was the most outrageously gaudy 1970s nouveau riche stuff. You know, he had large ceramic Afghan dogs standing in the doorways and gold carpet and things like that. It's that, you know, and he properly was a working class kid.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, made it good. And that's what you do when you make it good. You buy
ostentatiously expensive stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you kind of go, cause I can, it's like a dream. Yeah. Yeah. So he is like a kid in a candy store, isn't he? Trump, you know, and that's hence the cotton candy on his head. But so that in a way, I mean, it's a kind of cruel indictment of the taste of those kind of people who think that is tasteful, that you think, well, that's what it is to be rich. It's not having a yacht in Monaco. It's not having a, you know, being the inheritor of a title or something like that. That kind of quiet rich.
So our third example is from an Instagram post, actually, from a guy called Dennis Harms, which was on a Southwestern Airlines plane, where he found that behind him in coach was Don Jr. And so he took a selfie and said, how cool is this? He's traveling from Las Vegas to Phoenix Rally. And Don Jr. replied, reposted this and put, I'm not an elitist, never have been, never wanted to be, and certainly never tried to get on the BS rubber chicken dinner circuit. I like fishing, hunting, red meat, trucks and guns. So the rubber chicken thing is a phrase that means the kind of political, like, you know, $500 a plate gala type thing. I don't know why it's the rubber chicken thing, because it just makes me think of Fozzie Bear.
It just makes you think of those squeaky chickens.
Yeah, I think
that, exactly, yeah.
He's saying, oh, yes, I fly coach. I like fishing, hunting, red meat, trucks and guns. And that's very much the kind of the persona that they've tried to craft for themselves, hasn't it? He and Eric, especially.
Yeah. It's as much as he could do to not put fish in with no G. Fish and hunting,
trucks,
red meat,
and guns.
Trucks and guns. It would be good if you actually... Trucks
it's
and
practically
guns.
A Garth Brooks song in there, just in the...
It is... Right there, yeah.
But
all it needs is a gal and a dog
and some beer.
Yeah,
yeah. He didn't mention beer.
It's a beer. No, doesn't like beer. But yeah,
one journalist pointed out that this plane, and in fact Southwest Airlines, didn't have a first class on the plane, so he couldn't have flown first class. The only way he could have got from where he was to the Phoenix Rally without flying coach would have been to go on a private plane, which he could have done. And, you know, hooray for Don Jr. that he didn't and flew with normal humans. But
normal humans
for
a while, just to see how it is to be a normal human. Yeah, and then, of course, he bumps into not normal humans that say, look, he's an ordinary fella. You know, snap out of it, you fools. Yeah. He's not. Yeah.
They're just like us.
Do your research. They're just like us.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Of course, in British politics, our go-to common man of the people, you wouldn't mind drinking and exchanging outmoded, misogynist, risque jokes from the 70s with, is, of course, Nigel Farage, which should, being a proper British Cockney geezer, be pronounced Farage. To rhyme with garage, like the Mitchell Brothers' place of work in EastEnders, part Svengali, part harumphing cab driver, Farage has cultivated this persona of an ordinary bloke. But he's a bloke who's not afraid to expose the excesses of the fat cats, a bit like, you know, and the metropolitan liberal elite, just like Trump. And he is, like all racists, the happiest when he's pontificating in the pub. So here's a recording of him chortling, and that's his other thing. He chortles like a bloke does, and he's in the pub. And the only problem is he's not being really held to account by the interviewer, because the interviewer's from the Daily Telegraph. So, So he's chortling about how he got banned from his local. He got banned from a local because he was mobbed by the press on the day that Article 50, which was the article to withdraw from the European Union, was invoked. And it's ahead of the general election that eventually ushered in Boris and his get Brexit done thing.
You in the pub. I was enjoying it. What it was, all the world's media descended upon the Marquess of Granby. And I had my Union Jack socks on, obviously. You know, front page of national newspapers, global media was me and the Marquess of Granby. And I think, you know, they've got to be slightly careful.
They've got nervous.
You are Mr. Brexit.
You may find queasiness in London.
Mm.
You might find it in Canary Wharf. I mean, after all, you're earning £1 million a year. You're going to be quite slightly queasy, aren't you, about what's going to happen? You may find it in sections of the liberal media. You'll certainly find it in Westminster. You go out into the broader country. Is the public queasy about Brexit? No, they're saying get on with it.
So he's kind of saying, actually, you know, this Brexit thing is, it's a people's thing. And yeah, you know, you'll, of course you'll moan about that if you work in the city earning £1 million a year, which incidentally he used to. So, and also note that his local watering hole, the pub, is not the Red Lion or the George Cross or the steaming puce gammon, but it's the Marquess of Granby. You know, a proper ordinary pub that people drink in, the Marquess of Granby. And see, all the clues that he's a complete sham persona and that he isn't one of us, and it's a complete construct, that they're right there in plain sight. And later on, we get to see behind the scenes of the construction of this persona. They're on BBC's Question Time in that same period, as part of the BBC's somewhat clumsily blind adherence to the rules of featuring each party leader. And I think it was blind because Farage only created the Brexit Party a few months before in order to ensure more mass media coverage for his petty and somewhat faux anti-EU, anti-xenophobia, utterly racist, self-aggrandizing drivel. Because his space in the spotlight had gone since Boris had moved the Tories far enough to the right to capture and appease, if you like, the voters from Farage's former UKIP party. So Farage created the Brexit Party because he didn't think Brexit would be done, but also to thrust himself back into the limelight. Fortunately, he's disappeared somewhat, and he's, you know, he's got fewer listeners and viewers than we have, which is gratifying. But here he is telling us how he's one of us. And he understands sacrifice, and he's principled, and he's altruistic.
Look, I gave up a career in business. I closed down a company to go and do this. I didn't better myself doing it. I was actually far worse off doing it. And I'd point this out to you. I did not do this to advance my career financially. I made a sacrifice to do it because I believe we should be a free country. And I believe that today more strongly than ever before.
Giving it all up for us. That's right. He had a career in business, and he's earning less money now. You know, he's not in it for the money, not in it for the financial gain. He's sacrificing it because it should be a belief. And you kind of go, well, yeah, thanks, Nigel. That's great. Also, you fucking arrogant sod. You know, it's kind of, yeah, great. You're like one of us. You know about business and sacrifice and stuff like that. And of course, like all good cabbies, he talks in matey terms about the much-loved NHS.
We all want a National Health Service that works. I've had more need of it than most people with several disasters in my life. And when it comes to emergency care, there's nothing better in the world.
But he's going on actually to talk about how it should be paid for. And he adds an appeal to empathy, saying, well, I'm just like you. I've had my own brushes with disaster. You know, what's that? Death, terrible illness, disaster, failure at the ballot box. No, this was him talking about crashing in a microlight aircraft during an election campaign. As we all do.
Yeah, yeah. Just
but
like
it's just like us.
Just like everyone.
Just like everyone. Unfortunately, he survived. Yeah. And the cabbie's favourite, he talks about being accused of being racist.
So, OK, you'll love this. You'll love this. You'll love this. So I was at the BBC on Sunday morning, left at 10 a.m, and one of the security guys said, there's a protest outside. I said, OK, I'm used to that. So I walked out, and there they were, carrying placards, about a dozen of them. Jeremy Corbyn's a racist. Jeremy Corbyn's an anti-Semite. Jeremy Corbyn's the terrorist friend. And I walked past these protesters, and they came up and asked me for selfies with them. All right? I have not had an accusation like that made for many, many years.
Which is equivalent of, I'm not being racialist, but mixed in with a little bit of, but see, I'm the popular one. People want selfies with me. I'm down with the kids. And also a quick dig at Corbyn in a whataboutism kind of way. And of course, we're on his behalf. We'll gloss over the fact that other people have called in the street have called him scum and thrown milkshakes all over him. So he doesn't recall that bit. But this fallacy of the common man, the common bloke, does get countered. His faux persona as one of us does get called out by some savvy people in the audience that throw back the curtain to reveal the small, embittered man operating the controls in the same question time. So a member of the audience says this.
It really bothers me that you label yourself as unique and different from other politicians, because actually you are a man of wealth and privilege. You're a privately educated ex-banker. You boasted that you had received £2 million in taxpayers' money to support you in your role as MEP. And then in 2014, you wrongly didn't declare over £200,000 worth of gifts that you'd received in your role. Now, with a background like that...
I'm sorry, this is ludicrous.
With a background like that, how on earth can you understand what it is like for the 14 million people in this country who are currently living in poverty?
I love it when the audience members in question time come with the receipts.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And they just read the stuff out, and then he goes, "Well, that's ridiculous." Yeah, that comes. And in the final clip, there was a program, don't know, 5 years ago, no, 3-4 years ago, called Newsoids, which was kind of the CGI equivalent, the inheritance of the mantle of Spitting Images, satirical political show, and they spotted this, and it opens. It's got Farage backstage preparing to go on, and the little sketch opens with, and if the audience don't like you, it's their fault. Remember, Nige? And that's where, you know, he's straight there with, well, that's just ludicrous. Well, it isn't. It's not. Yeah, it is laughable. It's laughable what you're doing. Yeah, you're right. In that sense, it is ludicrous. And then he goes on actually to say to them, look, sweetheart, you've come here with you and your friends have come here with an agenda. And you go, well, yeah, like you haven't. And you also think, well, actually, if you're trying to appeal to, you know, it's a very select man of the people thing, a bit like Trump. I'm only men with of you people, the people that are like you but disagree with me. I'm not like them. So, yeah. So in this sketch, there's a little... there's a song, and he's backstage getting his character, and he's being haunted by his true, rich, privileged Huguenot descended self. Here's a clip.
I'm just an ordinary bloke. I like a drink, I like a smoke. I'm proud to say I'm British through and through. I love pie and mash and kippers. I watch Top Gear in me slippers. I am down to earth like any one of you. Ahem. I think foreigners are vermin. But hang on, your wife's a German. I'm English to the core. That's just a show. Sod off. I'll admit you played a smart game, but you've got a foreign surname, and your ancestors from France were Huguenot.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
May we?
Here. You're abusing your position just like any politician. But it seems like no one's noticed. Ah. Cheers.
It seems like nobody's noticed. However, well, yeah, there's also, just as a side note, I've noticed that Farage uses look to preface what he's about to say. He goes, look, whatever, and it's, it's something calculatingly matey about that. And annoyingly, I note it whenever Labour's Tony Blair and Ed Miliband and even Tories... David Cameron want to appear matey, and Men of the People, they all use that. They all go, look, da, 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 which is a kind, it's both hectoring and also kind of matey at the same time. And speaking of David, just call me Dave like I'm one of you, Cameron. He spotted the subterfuge in Farage back in 2014 after the anti-EU UKIP party ironically won seats in the European Parliament. And irony of ironies, to do exactly what Cameron was advocating, which was to remain in and reform the EU and not leave. And at the time, Man of the People, Dave, said this about Farage. listening to him on the radio and television for the last few days, it all seems supremely tactical. It's about trying to grow votes in clusters or something in different parts of the country. I don't really accept this thing. He's a consummate politician. We've seen that with his expenses and his wife on the payroll and everything else. So I don't really accept the he's a normal bloke down the pub thing. And when David, we're all in this together, Cameron calls you out, you kind of go, yeah, that's, and he's spotting it in somebody else saying, yeah, you're not a normal bloke. He's not a normal bloke down the pub.
And I like it when he says, it's like, he's a consummate politician with his expensive as your wife on the payroll. And I should know.
Oh, I just know. Yeah, that's exactly what
it takes one to spot one.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're hectoring of the politician to subsidise failing investment companies that I have an interest in. Yeah, I should know. She said, I want to look for world fallacies. I want to go wherever the fallacies are. I want to look for wild fallacies. I want to look for fallacies in the wild. Well, what else could I do? I said, I'll see what I could do. Pulp there, of course, with Common People.
The only reasonable choice for this thing this week.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, the entire episode has been wrapped around that, really.
So in The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective, and our first example is from the kind of glory days of Saturday Night Live. This was Phil Hartman, the late, great Phil Hartman, doing the unfrozen caveman lawyer sketch.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman. I fell in some ice and later got thawed out by some of your scientists. Your world frightens and confuses me. Sometimes the honking horns of your traffic make me want to get out of my BMW and run off into the hills or whatever. Sometimes when I get a message on my fax machine, I wonder, did little demons get inside and type it? I don't know. My primitive mind can't grasp these concepts. But there is one thing I do know. When a man, like my client, slips and falls on a sidewalk in front of a public library, then he is entitled to no less than $2 million in compensatory damages. And $2 million in punitive damages.
I love that. The honking of makes me get out of my BMW.
Yeah, and this is obviously just an extension of the trope of, you know, the simple country lawyer like Matlock.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it was Jimmy Stewart in Anatomy of a Murder was kind of one of the first great examples of, I'm just a simple man. I'm not a big, fancy, high-priced city lawyer with braces and stuff like that. So it's kind of very much trying to get the jury to see, like, you don't need to be intimidated by me. I'm not some brilliant, intelligent, rich lawyer. I'm just a guy like you. And in this case, he's kind of going even further and going, I'm scared by your modern world. So you can trust me when I know this thing about the law, because I don't understand anything. Yeah. So if I can get this, that's what it's going for. And it's the same with the simple country hyper chicken in Futurama, I may not know much, but I know this. And so you can trust me when I say this. So our second example is from Scrubs. This was from season 3 of Scrubs, where the kind of main characters are all still quite new doctors. And JD in this episode has just kind of saved someone's life by beating another doctor to the room. And when there was a code going, the large black family of the guy he saved are thanking him.
Dr. Dorian, you can't imagine how grateful we are.
Let me ask you something. Who's the cool doc you call when you want to save your husband, Paul?
JD!
It's from Shaft? Come on, how could you guys not get that?
Yeah, that's our Citizen Kane. Anyway, Thanks again. You're a real hero.
Oh, please. I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like you guys. Except after I put my pants on, I save your husband's life.
So, yeah, that phrase of I put my pants on one leg at a time, one just like everyone else, is reasonably common in this kind of scenario where it's like, you know, don't treat me like a hero. Don't treat me as different from you guys. I'm the same. We're all just the same in certain ways. I just save do this husband. Or I just have way more money than you do, or I just, you know, whatever
the thing about the,
whatever the difference is that is unspoken.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing is that for comedic terms, the gag is making the fallacy obvious by voicing the bit that is the difference, you know, that makes you uncommon. Whereas in politics, they keep that bit unvoiced. And that's... Because if you did that, it would prick the bubble of your... It makes you a kind of... It makes you pompous in a way. It's like, yeah, I'm just like you. I put my pants on one leg at a time. And then I save your husband. You know, that's right, because I'm a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost like, I'm just like you. My butler helps me put my pants on one leg at a time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, handily enough, that's kind of in the... And I don't know how I happened upon this. Don't ask me. But the tale of the prince and the pauper is pretty much that thing. You know, we talked about Trading Places and all that kind of stuff. It's very similar. But there was a Barbie version, a Barbie 3D animated.
You don't have to
version.
Cover. I know you love the Barbie cartoons.
Oh, that's so good. No. And this bit, there's a bit in it where they're realizing, you know, they kind of meet. So it's the princess and the
the porpoise, the princess,
the
and the porpoise,
porpoise. Princess and the porpoise. She tells she the porpoise tells Barbie this. Yeah, if I want eggs, I have to walk a mile, go get them from a chicken, and then you know, and then I have to eat them cold because I'm not allowed to use any heat. Blah 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 blah. How is it for you? And Barbie says,
Well. If I want some eggs, I ring the bell, and the maid comes running in. And she serves them on a silver tray, and she brings a cookie tin. And while I eat, she rubs my feet, and strolling minstrels play. But I'd rather be in my library, reading science books all day. I'm just like you.
You are?
You're just like me. There's somewhere else we'd rather be. Somewhere that's ours. Somewhere that dreams come true. Yes, I am a girl like you.
It's amazing. Except for our hair. We could be twins. What about this birthmark? No, I guess not.
Here, Your Highness.
Then, of course, the handsome guy comes out with two drinks and looks at them both and realizes they look exactly the same. So there's just, you realize that actually Barbie is so not common, not like the other, the porpoise, the pauperess, in so many aspects, not least in her lack of largesse. I mean, the pauper kind of goes, well, you're just like me. No, I'm just like you. You're just like me. Really? How is that then? I have a maid that brings me eggs and a cookie tin and rubs my feet while I eat them. You know, no, she's just saying, you know, in that kind of expansive, let's look behind the elitism, that actually we all want to be somewhere else because Barbie would much rather read her science books. Yeah, right. So she kind of goes, oh, yeah, well, you're just like me. I'd rather be somewhere else. I'd rather not be an unpaid skivvy serving food to the likes of you with your elite ways. And the other, and then she says, all in all, I'm a girl like you. And then Barbie rubs it in even more by saying, yeah, but what about this birthmark? Like, lifts up the sleeve of her gown, and on her arm is the perfect birthmark of a crown. And then the pauper does the same arm, goes, oh no, guess not. And you think, but other than that, We're twins, yeah. And it sets up the plot for them to swap places, obviously, blah blah blah. But you know, and you just think, It's like Paris Hilton, basically, isn't it? It's kind of, I'm just like you. I'm just a kid with a, you know, dad's a billionaire and owns a million hotels, and I've never had to want for anything. But other than that, I'm exactly like you.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
You see, I realised that actually I've been going all wrong all this time trying to go out on my own. I should just, you know, represent everybody else. Just, I'm just like you. I'm just giving it a go, one shot at a time, you know, and I can feel you rooting for me. So thanks, everybody. I hope I do you proud.
Yeah, we do occasionally get people getting in touch with us and saying, come on,
commiserating
Mark,
with me. We don't get anybody doing that. We get people going, yeah, one day you'll get on with it. What's the matter with you? I've got them all right so far. You know, they can see clear. Well, you know, obviously they got the hindsight of skipping forward a bit, listening to the, and then coming back and listening to them and going, oh, yeah, no, that's clearly the one, that one. You know, and then taking me to task. Yeah. Yeah.
So our theme this week is Trump's reactions to sports teams with problematic mascots or symbols changing their names. He doesn't like it. Much like the Confederate military bases, which tried to take the names of enemies of the United States off their bases. And he was like, no, not having that.
Don't do that. Yeah, and it's all, there's kind of the current furore in the sleepy Cotswold village where they've got it's called the Black Boy Pub, and the pub's going, I think we ought to change that, you know. Yeah, it's not good. Let's get rid of it. And the MP is up in arms. And you go, what?
So, the first statement, this was when the Cleveland Indians decided to change their name. He says, if I were an Indian, I'd sue. Sue them, Indians. What could be better? Especially if you have a good team. It's one of the greatest names, one of the most incredible logos. People loved it. They are going absolutely crazy in Ohio over the name change. Cleveland Guardians? What's all that about?
Brilliant. And he's just so, he's so culturally deaf that actually saying, if I were an Indian, I'd sue.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, And they, and that's on one level, and on the on the other level, it's a lovely logo, a completely demolished, ousted, and marginalised people, if that's a logo, people love it,
Statement number two. Now I hear the Chiefs are looking at changing their name. Everyone in the great state of Kansas, great people, they are, it's true, are furious and hugely insulted, and so are all the Indians I know. Nobody wants this except the radical left, who will stop at nothing.
How many Indians does he know? Exactly.
Statement number three.
Okay. Yeah.
And this one was a tweet. He says, they name teams out of strength, not weakness. But now the Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians, two fabled sports franchises, look like they're going to be changing their names in order to be politically correct. Indians, like Elizabeth Warren, must be very angry right now.
You see, but it's just, he's just a crazy old fucker, isn't he? God damn it. Okay, all I can think about is Indian motorcycles, and they sort of kind of going, maybe we should change that. Yeah. Mm. Okay. I really do want to hear him say Indian and Sioux in the same sentence. Okay. Greatest names, incredible logos. People loved it. It's true. Great state of Kansas. Well, there's a gap there. People in Kansas, where is he? Kansas? It could be. Everyone in the great state of Kansas. Great people. They are, it's true. Yeah. So that sounds live and real. Does he know the word radical? Okay. 90s out of strength. That sounds like him as well. But I want number one to be real. Okay. Right.
Okay, I think then that I'm quite convinced by strength as well. Right, for all the wrong reasons, I'm going to go for the number two is the one you made up.
Okay, so of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
Again, the wrong reason, because I just wanted to hear him say it. I think number one.
Okay.
Is I've done about convinced. To hear, more like. Yeah.
So, number one is real.
Such as, if I were an Indian, I'd sue them Indians. I mean, what could be better? You know, they, especially if you have a good team, the Cleveland Indians, it's one of the greatest names, one of the most incredible logos. People loved it. They are going absolutely crazy in Ohio over the name change to Cleveland Guardians. What's that all about?
Yep. Sue them Indians.
Yes, sue them Indians.
Well, I mean, apart from anything else, on what grounds?
Yeah, yeah. You know, sue them over the ancient theft of ancestral land.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The number of times that Trump has been sued, you would think he would have some understanding of the process, the requirement for standing, some...
In a court of law.
You know.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, he threatens to sue people, and that seems to work. I don't know whether it... You know, I'm not going to pay you, and if you demand money, I will sue you. Do they then stop demanding it, or do they just sue him? And so he's got a billion lawsuits.
Tragic win rate, an amazing loss rate in court.
Exactly. Yeah. So. Yeah. And but are there also, my other question is, are there any actual Native American Indians in the Ohio, in the Cleveland team?
Oh, I don't think so.
No. So it's clearly just exploitation.
That was never part of the name. That was never part of the reason for the name.
No, let's just count how many people, how many we've got in here. What nationality are we? Well, there's three Americans, three people from Ohio, and you guys are all Native American Indian. Well, that's what we call ourselves then.
Yeah,
that'll be it. Yeah, the Cleveland Indians, because there are so few of them that actually that's going to be quite a unique selling point. That we'll just have the Cleveland Indians. And people go, you've got Indians in Cleveland? Yeah, and they're all in our team. That, but no, none of that. Just makes no sense at all.
No.
So you might as well change it. Not going to make any difference. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so number three.
Yeah, so you also think that number three is real, and number three is...
Yeah.
Real.
Oh.
I can't play it because it's a tweet.
But, yeah.
But it,
blimey.
Yeah, it is a real tweet.
Wow.
And yeah, he did invoke the Elizabeth Warren thing at the
what
end there again.
What the hell? And they must be Indians, like Elizabeth Warren, must be very angry right now. But yeah. Why?
Much like they were when you were calling her Pocahontas, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's what he's saying. It's probably, is it not contemporary with that? You know, Elizabeth Warren seems to be really angry, and I don't know why.
This was
can't think
a
why
little
she
bit
is.
Further back.
Right.
This was when he had Twitter, so.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
yay.
So that means I did make up the Chiefs. I don't even think the Chiefs are. I think they've looked at changing their name, but I don't think...
They ought to have done. It was a good
but,
setup.
Yeah, but he did. The part of the thing that I based that on, where he's saying the great state of Kansas was after the Super Bowl last year,
right?
When he said that because the Chiefs won, and he said that everyone in the great state of Kansas was you know very happy, and the Chiefs, the Kansas City Chiefs from Missouri,
right?
So they aren't from the state of Kansas
at all. Brilliant. I don't think we're Kansas anymore, Toto.
But yeah, he didn't say that.
Yeah. Hey!
So, which means that you are now on 34 out of 71.
Fantastic.
Which is, I think, back to 48%.
Brilliant. You see, people, so. I did it. Thank you. I'm just like you. I'm, you know, one game at a time. I put my brain in gear one leg at a time, just like you guys. Yeah.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Ivermectin is Not a Logical Fallacy, because we talked about this briefly in the last episode.
Yeah.
About the horse paste.
It's not made from horses. It's paste. It's paste they put on horses.
Yeah, it's not made.
It's
of,
not horse no, paste. Not it's paste made of horses.
It's an anti-parasitic drug that in humans is used for people who have head lice or various other parasites, and
right.
It's also used in for sheep as like as a deworming treatment, and for horses and cattle. And the reason that was important was because people were struggling to get it from their doctors as a COVID treatment, and so were going to farm supply stores to get the horse version.
Okay, yeah, which I imagine
because you know
five times the size. Because when somebody says horse pills, it's always that well, kind of comedic prop tablet that's the size of your hand. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the sheep version, which is called Sheep Drench, is it comes in these giant kind of gallon tubs. So
are you supposed to swim in it? Or what, you know? Or is it like a light?
It's
you know,
to
like,
be in
a healing?
Ingested.
Ingested?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
But anyway, this is about what we're talking about today is about the study that originally led people to believe that this was a good thing to do.
This is the one.
There was actually one previous study that came out that was then withdrawn. But the main one that people still point to was a study by a guy called Ahmed Elgazar from Benha University in Egypt. And it was, or at least it claimed to be, a randomized controlled trial. They claimed it was blinded. And it showed significant improvement and reduction in mortality rate in groups treated with ivermectin by up to 90% reduction in mortality. And it was published on a website as a preprint. So it wasn't...
Right.
This was before it had been submitted to peer-reviewed journals.
Okay.
And so, but still, it was kind of they were publishing their findings and the data sets and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And
90%. That's the same kind of effectiveness as the vaccines.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In
so it was significant,
you know, on the face
in terms
of
in terms of what effect. They claimed it had. And basically, that was largely kind of accepted by the medical community in terms of, okay, this is interesting. We should do more studies. We shouldn't just assume
look at this.
We should wait for it to be published, wait for it to be peer-reviewed. But what an interesting opening results that these people have come up with. And a medical student called Jack Lawrence in London was given this paper to read kind of as part of his study, and he actually read it like in detail and thought, well, this seems
doesn't
a little bit
up.
Too good to be true, and a lot of these things don't make sense. And just some of the kind of most obvious things that didn't make sense: the people in the study were split up into groups of 100. It was both prophylaxis and treatment of COVID. And so they had 400 people that were kind of diagnosed with COVID, 200 of which had kind of mild or moderate symptoms, and 200 had more severe symptoms. And they were each split up into 100 each, and given one of those groups was given hydroxychloroquine, and one of the groups was given ivermectin. And the other 200 were people who were kind of carers. And people who were coming into contact with people who might have COVID, and they were given a kind of prophylactic dose.
Right.
And so one of the first things that stood out was the fact that these were such neat groups, that they had six groups, each of which had exactly 100 people in it. Mm-hmm. And they all kind of fit the same criteria, those 100 people. And they were kind of followed through to the end of the study. So normally you'd have kind of similar groups or similarly sized groups, ideally, if you've done good weighting and done good, good collection of people. But some people are going to drop out for various reasons over the course of the study. You're not going to end up with exactly the same across six groups. So it kind of started to ring alarm bells, and Jack Lawrence sent the study to a few people, one of whom was a guy called Nick Brown, who is basically he kind of looks at numbers. His speciality is forensic numerical data analysis.
Nice.
And so he looked at the numbers in the data set from the point of view of what kind of things would we expect to see in a standard trial, in a randomized control trial, particularly things like that. And he wrote a very, very detailed article about some of the problems, I guess, that he found, or the major problems that he found, which included, I mean, things that made it implausible that these results were real. One of the things that he found was that a lot of the data sets, the individual patients, had clearly been cloned from one part the data set to another. So there was like a group of 18 cells.
So they got changed the names or something?
Yeah, well, they're obviously not identified, but they're numbered, and they have like information about the extent of the illness and so on, and he found groups of kind of 23 rows of cells that were identical to 23 rows of cells further down the list, where it had obviously just been, you know, they were like, we don't have that many people, we'll cut and paste this group, including typos. So there was like was written COGUH for several of the people, and it was the
that
same
got copied as well.
Replicated. And so he split these up into kind of which bits had been replicated, and made a little diagram, and there were literally kind of 12 or so sections where there were 10 or more cells with the same data that had been clearly pasted from one place to another. And the randomization that was supposedly used, he ran kind of statistical analyses on the numbers based on a thing we've talked about before, which is called Benford's Law, which was someone was trying to use Benford's Law to prove that the people who had voted for Biden or Trump were statistically impossible, essentially.
Yeah.
And they'd done it wrong, because what Benford's Law does is it shows what, in a given population size, what numbers you would expect to see for the trailing digit, or for the kind of tens column digit, if these numbers are truly random. And what would your distribution be expected to be given your kind of population size? And for trailing digits, if assuming like all your numbers are above 10, if your numbers are really random, you'd expect to see your trailing digits all be roughly the same. Mm-hmm. If there's a certain amount of rounding, then you might expect to see a few more zeros than the other numbers. But basically, you should be seeing numbers that are largely the same. And what he found was that there were large groups of these sets of data where the kind of the trailing digit, the ones, the units, was in the first half of that, like 1 to 5. Like 80% of them were 1 to 5, and 20% were 6 to 0. And other large groups where there wasn't a single 2 and things like that. And he basically said, this is exactly what you'd expect to find if someone was trying to make it look random.
Make it look like.
Because people are terrible at that. Humans.
At doing random, making things
when
really
they're putting
random
in data that they think, oh, yeah, this, oh, I haven't had a 3 in a while, I'll put that in. It's, Yeah, they're really, really bad at
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
More problems that the original medical student found, Jack Lawrence. He found that the introduction to the study had been plagiarised from other studies. He'd basically just got chunks of the text from the introduction, pasted it into Google and found other studies that had the exact same text. He found that although they claimed that they'd started doing the study on a particular date, actually a big chunk of the people that they were looking at had died before that date. The like of like 40% of the people who had died during the study actually died before they claimed the study started. They originally claimed that their participants were between 18 and 80, but they also had like birth dates and several of them were under 18. And it was just this, all of these things were indications that the data that they were claiming they were looking at, you know, actual real groups of existing people and writing down stuff about them, it really makes it look like none of these people ever existed, and it's just data that they made up. As an example of one of the kind of statistical things that looked odd is the distribution of patient ages. So in out of the 600 patients, there were, for example, 34 aged 48, but only 3 aged 50. So that's kind of unlikely that it wouldn't be more evenly spaced. But even more than that, out of 600 patients, 410 had an age that was an even number of years compared to 190, that's an odd number of years. That's significantly off over that number of people. It's a smallish sample size for a study, but like if you flip a coin 600 times, you're going to get pretty close to 300 heads and 300 tails. It's not going to be exact, but 400 of one of them. And I mean, that's binomial probability because there's only two options. And the guy, Nick Brown, said if you basically plug that kind of binomial probability into a function, you get the probability that is happening by chance is something like one in a quadrillion. It is extremely small chance, and for the probability of 399 out of 600. The real number was 410, but above 400, the thing he was using can't represent how small the chances of that happening are.
So. Wow, he hasn't got the infinite improbability drive to do it on. Wow.
So basically, anyone who is pushing ivermectin is pointing to this study, and it is it's plagiarized. It uses almost certainly made up data, definitely cloned and copied data.
So even if you took out if you took out all the clones, how many does that leave behind? So it actually becomes a tiny.
Well, the interesting thing is it's kind of groups. They've cloned different parts of the data across different parts of the patient population. So it's not like one kind of all of the columns for each patient
have been copied.
Have been replicated.
They've just been randomly
it's
shoved in.
Exactly what you'd expect if someone was trying to make it look like they had more data than they have without making it too obvious. Yeah. But and in fact, in places,
use the same stuff and repeat bits of it elsewhere.
Yeah, in places there are large sections which are repeated, with a couple of cells which have been altered by a digit or two here and there.
Right.
Which makes it even more looking like it's, you know, someone has deliberately gone in and tried to make it look a bit less obvious what they've done.
It feels like what you do on a film set, doesn't it? You kind of go,
no one's going to look at this. It just needs to look like data.
Exactly. It just needs to look like data. So when we flip through it, as we pan across, it looks convincing. Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, one of the other things that Nick Brown found was that in a lot of cases in like cells have been formatted incorrectly, so instead of a zero there's a lowercase o, and things where it's, you know, commas have been used instead of decimal places, and so the formatting of the cell is different because in Excel, numbers default yep. over to the right-hand side of the cell and text defaults over to the left.
Yeah.
But to make yep. it look the same, they've kind of used spaces and things to move the...
To push it over.
Yeah, to push it over. And, wow. and that kind of thing means
yeah, yeah.
that they couldn't possibly have used this data, this spreadsheet, to do any calculations, to do any formulas, because it would have thrown up yes. all kinds of errors.
Yes, yes.
Because a lot of yep. the numbers in there aren't even numbers.
Numbers, yeah.
So, yeah, this is a...
Yeah.
It's so obviously not a real study. And it's a bit scary yeah. that it was accepted as such, and you know, it took a random medical student a couple of hours of looking at it to go, something's weird here.
Wait a minute. Yeah, that's not a naught, that's an O. Yeah, yeah. Or there are too many of this and not enough 50-year-olds. Yeah.
Yeah, but
what are the chances of that?
This is
work it out.
This is dramatically skewing any kind of meta-analysis that is being done about ivermectin,
yeah.
where there are smaller yeah. studies and this one, this is the one that's pushing it over the boundary of, yeah. yes, it looks like it's worth studying. If you take this out,
right.
it very much falls back onto nothing. The side of, yeah, there's really no effect. Or nothing, you know, nothing statistically wow. significant. So
it makes you actually think, well, what's the impetus for this study? Is you know, have they got shares in ivermectin? Is that the
yeah, the good question.
Who are making this study?
You know, I mean,
why make it?
That hasn't been answered.
You know, why go to that?
I don't even know yeah. if it's been yeah. asked yet.
Why go to that extent to make this look like that?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it hasn't been published anywhere, like in a peer-reviewed paper. And it certainly won't be now.
Exactly.
But we don't know if it's
disappeared
been submitted.
Off the,
yeah, they've removed it. The site
Research Square.
Research Square. Yeah, the Research Square has removed it.
Right
and,
now, yeah, it says withdrew this reprint due to an expression of concern communicated directly to our staff. These concerns are now under formal investigation.
Yeah. So they're going to be looking at it, and you know, it was up. Yeah. But it was up for a while. It was uploaded November of 2020, and it was only in June, July of this year that they started kind of questioning it.
Wait a minute. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, was it ever submitted to peer review? To like,
well, we don't know. We don't because they don't publish lists of things they have decided not to publish. So we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know if it's been, if they tried to get it into some peer review journals and couldn't, but it certainly hasn't been published anywhere.
Wow.
That's
kind of frightening because, you know, some anti-vaxxers known by me are quite over the moon about ivermectin. They're kind of going, oh, well, I'll get that. You know, and you think, well, how much is that costing? And and there's been a resistance to my questions about, well, where is that study? What's this based on? And just because a particular well-regarded in that community practitioner has said, oh, yeah, you should look at this. This is the thing. That's, you know, that's just an appeal to authority.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Because he's wearing a white coat and he goes... Yeah. Yep, you know, the mainstream media are trying to do this down, so it feeds into...
Yeah, it's just because it's not
that sliding
mainstream.
Scale.
That's the weird thing. Yeah. I think it was Noah Illusions on Scathing Atheist who said recently that what we need is a COVID cure that, or a vaccine even, that is called the cure that doctors don't want you to know about, and then people take it.
Exactly. And that kind of... and that's all it needs, really, isn't it? It's or if you put some flowers on it and say, you know, nature's own remedy, that would be, you know, because nature's been doing it for years and years and years. I love we've talked about that often in the past, and we can go, yeah, nature also invented smallpox and measles, mumps and rubella. Yeah, you know, you can gargle horse paste all you like. It's not going to fix anything.
No.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Lumpy pillow salesman and less sexy Ron Jeremy, Mike Lindell, held his cyber symposium from August 10th to 12th, based on the belief that Trump would somehow magically be reinstated on August 13th. I've been a bit busy, to be honest. I haven't really been paying attention to the news lately, but I don't think that happened. I feel I would have heard about that. Anyway, Mike was given a Trump-signed MAGA hat by the president of Brazil, son, Edward Bolsonaro. The event lasted 72 hours, and a good chunk of that was Lindell trying to pronounce Bolsonaro. Other large sections of time were taken up by replaying the same conspiracy-filled documentary up to four times a day, which suggests to me he thought there'd be more questions after he presented his evidence. Like, he booked the room for 72 straight hours, but nobody had any follow-up questions for his obvious lies. So, show a movie? Mike offered $5 million to anyone who could prove his evidence was false, and when one cybersecurity expert pointed out that packet captures are in binary and whatever data he had was in hexadecimal, so definitely wasn't what he claimed it was, Mike withdrew the offer prize money. I like to think he's still sitting there genuinely shocked that it didn't work.
I once went to Seville in Spain during an Easter break and found myself unintentionally caught up in the Semana Santa Holy Week parades. Gathered throngs of hooded men representing artisan guilds and women in widow's weeds thronged the street and happily scooped me along as we followed effigies of the Virgin and Christ around the narrow streets towards the cathedral. A magical, peaceful, friendly accident. This is pretty much what MAGA hat-wearing, Capitol-building rioter Robert Reeder is using as his defence. Well, apart from the happy, peaceful, friendly bit. A good, honest Democrat supporter, it turns out, well, so he says, he heard that this might be Trump's last speech and so just happened along because he had nothing better to do. Way to carve yourself into history, Donnie. And before you know it, Your Honour, my client was an accidental tourist, caught up with people whose view he abhors. And just like any inquisitive tourist shouting fight for Trump, he accidentally breached the Capitol building twice. Boasted that he battled the police and witnessed an officer being assaulted. Not my client. He didn't care much for Trump and supported strongly the other guy. The opponent. Yeah, him, that one. Bernie, something or other. Of course, like all good modern tourists, he filmed himself doing all these things he said he didn't do and probably now faces a 6-month jail term. As Shaggy once said, Zoinks, Scoob! No, it wasn't me. And we didn't believe him either.
In case you didn't see it, things have kicked off in Afghanistan. The Taliban took over basically the whole country in 11 days, and of course Republicans are blaming Biden, conveniently ignoring the fact that Trump initiated the US withdrawal, saying in June,
I started the process, all the troops are coming back home, they couldn't stop the process. 21 years is enough, don't we think? 21 years. They couldn't stop the process. They wanted to, but it was very tough to stop the process.
So he boasted less than 2 months ago that he'd made it basically impossible for Biden to stop. He praised Biden's decision to move ahead with the withdrawal at the time. He negotiated the release of over 5,000 Taliban fighters, including Taliban leader Mullah Baradar, and touted a historic peace agreement with the Taliban, which the RNC have deleted from their website this week, and is now calling for Biden's impeachment because it turns out withdrawing has consequences. The weird thing is, in the fight to blame either Biden or Trump, George W. is getting away with murder.
Quite literally. A touchstone, lodestar, if you will, of dystopian imagery is Orwell's 1984, an indictment of our post-war government's coercion, as he saw it, of the public to go along with the building of their new vision for Britain. It remains a warning from history of the possibility of future totalitarianism. Referenced by skilled orators, this could throw into sharp relief the power of the media in the hands of a malicious administration. In the hands of Republican Representative Madison Cawthorn, it makes the GOP stock-marked laughing again. It seems to be a trope trotted out by increasingly incompetent communicators attempting to do down the opposition. Don Jr. and Lauren Boba have already had a go this year, claiming an Orwellian lack of free speech, or that the only thing George got wrong was the date. Madison's somewhat lamer contribution was to effectively file a book report like the kid who didn't do the reading assignment. Stood in front of the classroom represented by the whole of Twitter, he blurted, 1984 is a great fiction novel to read, but it seems like it is becoming the reality we are currently living under more and more each day. And Twitter laughed in his face, remarking such things as fiction novel And I recall going to see the movie film at the local cinema picture house and then driving my automobile car to my house home afterwards. Damn, these guys are good at the comms talking speech. When your own party's ex-president doesn't even know which way up to hold grasp a Bible scripture in front of a chapel church, it's a wonder any of them can read at all, let alone actually a whole entire story novel fiction tale.
James O'Keefe, the right-wing activist behind ironically named Project Veritas, is taking a break from misleadingly editing videos to star in a stage production of Oklahoma in Florida, alongside a cast of actors he claims are all cancelled artists, in an attempt to raise awareness about the effect cancel culture is having on the arts. True to form, this is bullshit, and as soon as Gorka started looking into it, several cast members said they hadn't been cancelled at all for anything, while another talked about people trying to get her fired for being racist but not succeeding. Meanwhile, Brian Claudus, the show's producer, had been running his own production company for a year before accusations were made at his previous job about him being racist and harassing cast and crew members, so not cancelled then. I guess billing it as a musical from a cast and crew of racist assholes who harass people doesn't quite sell as well. Although it is Florida, so who knows?
Just when we thought QAnoners could get no more crazy, do become a patron of the show and listen to us going through the invitation to the Great Awakening mad box of frogs, that they are frustrated at the vacuum left by Ron Watkins' Q, so the Anoners are looking to the secret queen of Canada. She isn't. Self-proclaimed HRH Queen Lady Romana Didulo, did you though? She apparently replaced Queen Elizabeth. She didn't, after she was executed for crimes against humanity. She wasn't. But go no further. That's all the qualifications you need to be followed by QAnoners who then go and harass US clinics and Walmart through the mail, holding them accountable for war crimes. Well, you know, because COVID. Apparently these heinous clinic criminals are violating various bits of the Nuremberg Code, the Geneva Convention, the United Nations Convention, in getting people to wear masks, get vaccinated, and generally care about one another. All make sense? No. Good. Because that's how you know you are sane. One QAnoner seems to be making it back from the dark side, though. I can get the word out about this, and I can get a lot of people to do this, wrote one fan. But I need some proof that the military is going to back this up. Give me some actual evidence that this will do something and I will blast it all over the internet. Blimey, you're going to get excommunicated talking like that, you heretic.
In just a few days after school started in Florida, there are over 1,800 confirmed COVID cases in a single school district, and 10,000 students and staff are quarantined, leading that district, Hillsborough, and also Miami-Dade, to hold emergency meetings and vote to defy Governor Ron DeSantis' anti-mask mandate. DeSantis will now no doubt explore whether he gets to withhold the school board's salary or whether slavery might be illegal. Meanwhile, in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott, who is trying to outstupid DeSantis on mask mandates despite currently having COVID himself, is being schooled by the Paris Independent School District, who found a loophole and have simply added masks to their dress code. Hey, maybe there's hope for an American education system after all.
In the utter Brit show that is tiny-minded diminished shitten this week, whilst Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, Dominic Raab, Foreign Secretary in the mould of the previous holder of the post Boris Johnson, couldn't be asked to speak to representatives in Afghanistan who called for the UK help in evacuating local people who had worked for the British Army as interpreters for the entirety of the 20 years they'd been there. No, because he was far too busy sunning himself on the beach in Crete as the airlifting of hundreds of Afghans was underway. But it's all right, because one phone call wouldn't have made any difference, said Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. Well, no, you're right. Because it would mean nothing coming from the upholder of the UK's inward-looking xenophobic foreign policy. Speaking of which, Priti Patel was wary of making too much noise about how much help we were giving to any Afghans fleeing for their lives and seeking asylum here, for fear it might send the wrong message to other refugees. Brexit was hailed as giving us the chance to be a more globally active and respective country. Yeah. How's that going? When even Theresa May, who fucked it up completely when in power by making Boris Johnson Foreign Secretary, tells the government to its face how much they've fucked it up. The problem's not Brexit, though. It's the bunch of power-crazed, self-obsessed hoorays who are only in it for a fast buck for themselves and their mates and have no idea what it is to be actually responsible for anyone else anywhere outside of their seniors' common room. The only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used the fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our strawman level patrons Max Beaver, Kaz Tui, Steve Bickell, Smoots, Mark Reike, and Amber R. Buchanan, and our top two Scotsman level patron Lauren. Thank you so much, everyone. We really do appreciate your support.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.